When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Nichelle De Silva, and I am absolutely delighted to be joined by Craig Robertson, who is an Associate Professor of Media Studies at Northeastern University, where he researches histories of paperwork, information technologies, identification documents, and surveillance. We will be talking about his new book, The Filing Cabinet, A Vertical History of Information, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2021. Welcome, Craig, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I'm really excited and intrigued to be here in the architecture part of the New Books Network.
Yes, and before I begin, I just want to note that while this might seem a bit of an unusual book to be featured on New Books in Architecture, I personally was very struck by the wide-ranging architectural implications of the filing cabinet for the office, for the home, for verticality itself, and how that is valued in the field, all of which I found really instructive as an architectural historian. Also, in looking at the filing cabinet, you really unpack the material and spatial processes of storage itself. And I thought it really spoke so well to other recent books that we've been seeing in architectural history on, say, logistics or warehousing, and a more general turn in the field to thinking critically about infrastructural and not just monumental architectural forms. So I'm really delighted to have you with us today. Could you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background, how you came to become a media historian?
Well, yes. So the media part of that is actually, that's what got me out of New Zealand, where I grew up, to the United States. I came to the United States in the mid-1990s because I wanted to study the cultural implications of alternative music, or what is often called college rock, in the United States. And after a couple of years, that sort of reached a dead end. So I took a break from graduate school, traveled and worked for a few years, and then returned to the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois, which is a fantastic interdisciplinary space. So that allowed me, with under their broad umbrella of communications and media studies, to sort of develop my research interests and agenda. And part of that involved going back to my undergraduate degree in New Zealand, which was a degree in history, and thinking about media and communication, not only historically, but very broadly. So I ended up writing a dissertation on the history of the passport. And therefore, without really planning it, suddenly the medium that I started to study as a media studies scholar or a media historian was paper.
Mm-hmm. I'm really sort of on the subject of paper. I'm really fascinated by histories of objects and systems that are so seemingly banal that the way that they organize the whole world is often very much overlooked. And it's so easy to overlook the filing cabinet until, of course, one has to deal with quantities of unsystematized and uncategorized paper, as you say. And this is something that you encountered when you were doing research for your previous book, so on the passport. So how did that very visceral experience as a researcher lead you to write about filing cabinets in this book?
Yeah, I was when I was studying my when I was doing research for the passport, I found myself at National Archives in the United States, and I was looking through 19th century correspondence between the State Department and consuls and embassies, and this is all actually stored on microfilm, but the original comes from these bound unindexed volumes. So what you had was just in chronological order, letter after letter after letter, bound in the office for Madrid, for example. And then the outgoing letters, I should say, were from the State Department, were bound in a different volume. And this made research really, really hard to do. So I would sort of alternate just between randomly pulling out, a microfilm reel and putting it on, or where sometimes I was able to use indexes, say, from the New York Times when those started. And if there was some controversy around a passport, I had some rough dates and I could kind of look. But it was really time-consuming, very unproductive, and was eating away at the limited amount of time as a graduate student that I was able to afford to do research at the National Archives. And then I arrived at 1906. And in 1906, the State Department introduced a numerical filing system. So all of a sudden, all the correspondence around passports for any given consular office and within the State Department had the same number. Each case was given a particular, decimal number within that. So my research just instantly became so much easier. And that was the experience when I really thought, wow, the introduction of numerical filing, the introduction of filing cabinets, right, really changed how people organized paper and organized information and approached information. And so that was something that I thought, this is curious. And when I finally found the time to kind of explore this a little more, because it was an experience that really stuck with me, what I discovered was that, first of all, I was not alone in my excitement at the arrival of numerical filing. This was a very big deal in the early 20th century. But what I discovered was that when people talked about that at that time, they framed it as a move from the bound book to the filing cabinet. So all of a sudden, when I was thinking, oh, there's something here in the history of classification, what happened is suddenly I found myself writing about the history of storage, right? And the history of storage technologies. And then, within that context, coming out of media studies, I understand, right, technology is not neutral, that technology is informed by power dynamics. And these shape the issues that are prioritized as problems to be solved by technology. And they also therefore shape the technological solutions. And so I think the argument, therefore, that storage technologies are not neutral is particularly important when the object being stored is information.
Absolutely. And it's, this is quite fabulous how this experience of moving from tedium, research tedium, to ease of research led you to a whole other book. And I want to now dig a little bit into the subtitle of your book, A Vertical History of Information. So you use this term very deliberately throughout the book to discuss the very particular vertical logic of storage that's embodied in the filing cabinet. And you touched on this a little bit in your previous answer, but if you could talk a little bit more about this, how exactly did the filing cabinet change in a very material way the relationship between paper and knowledge? So what did it change or make possible for information storage and retrieval? How was it different from the bound books that you mentioned as you were talking about your research experience? How was it different from these bound books that were previously used in offices? And what made it so modern? What made it so different?
Yeah, so the really innovative thing about the vertical filing cabinet, and it's something I think we don't necessarily think of, even if we do pause to think about it today, is that it completely changed how loose paper was stored. Mm-hmm. And what it did was it allowed loose paper to be stored on its edge, right? Because if you think about it, if you grab a piece of unbound paper now, it can't stand up on its long edge, or even its short edge, on its own. So that's the incredibly innovative move of the vertical filing cabinet, right? Because with the right size drawers, with what we call follower blocks or compressors, and then with the manila folders themselves that paper was stored in, all of this allowed paper to be stored on its long edge, right? And so loose paper vertically stored, right, in that way on its long edge is easier to access than loose paper that was stored flat. Because I was mentioning bound books, but you still had loose paper that wasn't bound, but it tended to be stored in piles, right? So it's harder to access the individual sheet of paper compared to when it's on its long edge. And so that, in terms of paper storage, right, that's the major innovation. And as I was suggesting when I was talking about the State Department records, what this then allows you to do is to access knowledge in more discrete amounts. My argument in the book is that this instrumental form of knowledge, right, the ability to access in a very sort of easy way knowledge, produces discrete and smaller, if you like, pieces of knowledge. And those pieces of knowledge came to be called information. Now, the word information obviously had existed prior to the late 19th, early 20th century, but in the previous like 100 years or so, it had moved from a process where information used to refer to the act of being informed, to being educated, to become a thing that could be possessed, retrieved, and circulated. So the filing cabinet didn't invent this idea of information, right? But it became, through manila folders, through the storage of loose paper, it became an important way to think about information as something discrete and particular, right? And this made it very different from the way information was approached when it was on pages that were bound in books, right? Which the bound volume creates this, or it puts a particular bit of a letter, some correspondence, within a broader context, the context of what was going on in the consul office in London in 1873. Now, you, rather than having that broader context, what you have is, through the technology of the manila folder and the filing cabinet, you have all the correspondence around one particular issue brought together. So that is the sort of innovation that the vertical filing cabinet brought. And in terms of that idea of vertical history, as I'm sure we'll discuss later on in this interview, the subtitle of the book is also playing off that idea of vertical paper storing on its edge to think about vertical history as a history that recognizes hierarchies and power dynamics, right? So therefore, the vertical history of information is a history of information that doesn't understand it as some inert and neutral sort of object, but rather as something that is has historical specificity.
Absolutely. And I really want to dig into these questions of the way in which information is stored in these smaller discrete blocks and the ways in which that plays to power. But right now I want to dig a little bit more into this question of very material verticality, because again, this is the New Books in Architecture Network. So I want to draw attention to some of the images that you have in your book that were particularly striking for me as an architectural historian. There are these promotional images that you show that juxtapose filing cabinets with skyscrapers. And this, as I understand it, on the part of the purveyors of these filing cabinets, it seems to underscore a view that equates height and verticality with economic efficiency. And you talked a little bit about this as well when you talked about how easy it was to retrieve these loose sheets of paper in a way that wasn't possible with the bound books. But could you talk a little bit more about some of the ways in which the filing cabinets were positioned spatially as aligning with or working together with the purported efficiency of the skyscraper, as well as other forms of efficient office furniture?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And as I was doing my research, I started to realize, right, that the period I'm looking at, which is basically the first half of the 20th century, that's the arrival of corporations, right, of large scale production. What people have called managerial capitalism or corporate capitalism. And what I realized is that this really depended on the vertical, right? It really depended on an understanding of verticality in different registers, right? But the key point was that the vertical becomes key, as you pointed out, to ideas of efficiency and productivity that define this era. So I argue in the book that in this era, like, capitalism has what I call a vertical bias, right? Not only in storage, such as filing cabinets and skyscrapers, but also even like outside of the office completely, we have the emergence of billboards and things like this. But also we have the idea integral to the development of corporate capitalism, which is vertical integration, right? What we now call vertical integration, the combining of multiple stages of production in one company. We also have the emergence of management, the management hierarchy, and with that, the corporate ladder, right? So, like I said, in different registers, I see the vertical as the vertical is considered a way to achieve efficiency. Right, where efficiency in the early 20th century is the idea that breaking things down into component parts, into as small parts, makes them easier to manage and control. And what happens is that these small parts are then contained increasingly within, if you like, a vertical structure. Right. So in the case of the skyscraper and the filing cabinet, what we really see here is that efficiency is linked to the idea of flow, right? The movement of people and paper, and through the combination of those two, the movement of information. And there's a great quote from one of the office equipment efficiency boosters, Elsie Walker, from a company called Shaw Walker. And he has this great line where he says, every time a piece of paper stops, a dollar is resting, right? And so, you know, this is where this, as I said, this idea of flow and efficiency is really important. And the skyscraper and the filing cabinet facilitate that flow, right? They force activities, in the case of the skyscraper, work or objects. In the case of the filing cabinet, paper, they force activities and objects into designated spaces, which makes it easier to manage flow, right? So in terms of the skyscraper, I would argue, you know, the skyscraper exists to contain the repetition of offices, the development of offices, particularly within the model of the skyscraper, is all designed about, you know, the movement of people within standardized spaces. And so we have within the filing cabinet, I mean, we have within the skyscraper, this sort of organization of horizontal layers, floors, or in the filing cabinet, horizontal layers of drawers, right? And right. So in all of this, right, what's going on is that verticality, right, is subordinating parts to a whole. And so it's in that sense, I would argue, that height and verticality are equated with economic efficiency. And then often was the case in my research, having struggled my way through this and thinking about this, I would then come across, you know, a quote from office management expert that just encapsulated it very succinctly. So we have William Leffingwell, who was sort of the founding figure of what was known as scientific office management. And he has this line in one of his textbooks where he says, the introduction of the vertical filing cabinet marked the utilization of a great efficiency principle, that there is always room for more growth in a vertical rather than a horizontal direction.
I can see that being a driving force in sort of both structures, large and small. And it seemed as though a lot of, you know, as you say, a lot of this efficiency seems to be about dividing things up in a very controlled manner, or rather controlling through the dividing up of things into very small components. And part of that is the gendered division of labor, a very sort of strictly demarcating gender roles, what women and men could or could not do. And some of the promotional materials in your book very clearly demarcate this gendered relationship between, or this gendered division of labor in the workplace, what women could do versus what was the purview of men in the office. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how the filing cabinets, forms of information storage and retrieval, were used to keep people in their quote-unquote place.
Yeah, so as your question sort of implies, I want to make explicit, right, is that labor is always situated, or work is always situated, in time and place, right? And in the case of filing, which is a new form of labor associated with the filing cabinet, or I should say filing gets redefined in relationship to the filing cabinet, it's situated, as you said, in the capitalist values of efficiency and productivity. But as you also noted in your question and the way you framed the question, these values are highly gendered, raced, and classed, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we have here basically is that efficiency depends upon this gendered division of labor. Efficiency depends upon the cheap labor of women, right? And so the arrival of women as workers is one of the things that defined the modern office, right? That made it very different from the offices that preceded it, particularly those in the 19th century. Women had worked in offices, of course, prior to the 20th century, but not in the numbers that they did as the 20th century began. And this is because women entered the office to take on and do very specialized tasks. So again, in the name of efficiency, because the thing that is normally broken up in the name of efficiency, broken up into small pieces, is labor, right? So in the office, that meant that the work of the 19th century male clerk got broken down into all these specialized tasks, and tasks that leaned much more towards what was thought of as manual labor. Those became the tasks that were assigned to women. Right. So women arrived in offices, therefore, to assist men. So in that sense, they occupied the same place that society gave their work at home. Right. The work of women at home was to maintain a house. Right. To assist a man. Right. To assist the family. And so filing and other low level office work, including secretarial work, was understood to be feminine work. So to put it really crudely, or as simply as the ads you alluded to put it, men did the thinking in the office and women cared for the office, right? So in this case, they ensured men had what was needed for them. And in language of many of the ads, they cared for the files. And this division is really clearly seen in advertisements, which made clear that filing was a task that was suited to women, and it was a task that did not require thought. So we can see this in two ways, in two kind of sets of advertisements. One involves a male executive who's working. And in many cases, the male executive is talking on the phone. And while he's talking on the phone, he's reaching into a file drawer in his desk and retrieving a file and not having to think about it. So an ad for what was called an efficiency desk captured this with a slogan that said something like, each compartment should represent a fixed place. This is each compartment in the drawer, so that the hand of the executive will reach automatically for the desired records without interrupting the continuity of brain action. Right. So again, here, so the man can do this without having to think, right? Anyone can do this without having to think. So when you have so many records and so many documents that they can't be contained in the desk of a male executive, they're in a filing cabinet, and there's no way, you know, a man is going to do that kind of work, right? That would be a waste, quote unquote, of a man's natural abilities. Rather, it's suited to the natural abilities of a woman. So it's work that doesn't require thought, and it's work that requires the handling of paper, right? And it's very much understood in this period, all these changes, I should say, in this period, changes in work are naturalized through this idea that women have nimble fingers, right? So you have this, you have employers asking women, you know, do you play the piano? Do you knit? Do you crochet? Do you sew? Or any other kind of work that would allow her to have improved her natural ability, the natural speed, if you like, of her fingers. And this gets captured in ads where in showcasing, right, the divisions in a file drawer and showcasing the tabs and the manila folders that break up paper, the ads sort of have close-up drawings of an open drawer, and sometimes they include the disembodied hands of a female file clerk reaching in. And obviously the constraints of the advertisement mean that you can't show the full body of the woman, but therefore what it also shows is this sort of ideal mode of labor, right? That you don't need to think, right? You just need hands to retrieve these papers because the file cabinet drawer is doing all the thinking for you, right? You know, in that sense, right. You know, the hand is often positioned as an extension of the body, the way the body and the mind makes contact with the world, right? You reach out and you grasp and touch, and there's a process of choice and deliberation about where you're reaching out or where you're touching. But what the ad is suggesting here is that in the case of filing, right, and gathering information, that choice is transferred to the predetermined pathways of the file cabinet drawer, right? So there's no connection to body and mind, right? And so therefore, going back to the question you asked several minutes ago, you know, this is the way in which we can understand how through filing the emergence of a very particular gendered division of labor that helps define and constitute the modern office.
Yeah, and it really seems, you know, from these promotional materials that they're really trying to manage, or I don't know what the right word for this is, push back on or resist or, you know, work with some really significant upheavals that are happening in the office in terms of an influx of women coming in, and they're sort of in truly mind-boggling ways in some ways objectifying, reducing women to objects. The picture of the hand, for example, another one that really struck me was that image that you showed of a young girl opening one of the filing cabinet drawers with a string, sort of infantilizing women in some ways as well. Like, you know, the idea being that a small child can open this drawer, and they're quite powerful and it's disturbing images in some ways.
No, they are. I mean, it's one of those things where you end up laughing at them, both because anachronistically they're funny, but also you kind of have to laugh at them, you know, before you cry in some ways, you know, at them. And I think, as probably has been made clear already, really, you know, this, so much of my argument depends in some ways and is really helped by these images. So I encourage people to go out and buy the book and see these wonderful images and really see that I'm not making this stuff up. You know, I mean, it's there in some ways as low hanging fruit, but thanks for bringing up that the image of the young girl with the thread of cotton opening the file drawer. So that's an ad that brings actually together a number of the questions you've already asked, right? So it comes from a company called Shore Walker. We met Mr. Walker earlier with his, you know, every time a piece of paper stops, a dollar is resting. So Shore Walker had this campaign called Built Like a Skyscraper. So they were one of the companies that really went for the comparison between the filing cabinet and the skyscraper. But within this, right, within this campaign, their signature image was a drawing of a man in a suit jumping into an open file drawer in a filing cabinet. And the whole premise of this is that the filing cabinet is this very your filing cabinet is not going to fall over. It's a sturdy piece of equipment because it's built like a skyscraper. And in another image that goes with both the images we talked about, a man is doing something that's almost like a push-up, I guess, again, on an open filing cabinet drawer, and the drawer isn't falling down. And the men doing these are dressed in suits, right? And I think what's happening here, and again, you were alluding, I think this is what you were getting to in your question, is that So this ad is set up, and on its surface, it's an ad. Well, it's designed or intended, I should say, to be an ad to showcase the strength of filing cabinets and particularly drawers and drawer slides. But really, I don't think it takes too much for a 21st century scholar, particularly one versed in ideas about gender and the representation of gender, to see that this ad really speaks to a lot of anxiety around the arrival of women into the office and what this meant for what was previously a predominantly male workplace, what this meant for the male workers who were there. And so I see in these ads that really stress the athletic ability of these males, a sense that they have not become feminized by the appearance of women in the office, right? That rather they are still these athletic, you know, manly men, right, who can, if need be, work out on a filing cabinet in their nice suit.
Yeah, the images are really wild. But to like sort of take this a little further and think about, you know, not just, so in some ways, these reconfigurations of the office with the influx of women to the workplace also seemed to either blur the boundaries between work and home or spill over in some ways into how domestic spaces were organized or expected to be organized as well. And you talk about this a little bit in the book, and I found that quite surprising because I think of the filing cabinet as so much a furniture of the place of employment. And I was curious if you could talk a little bit about how this process of organization spilled into the organization of the home.
Yeah, thanks. This is one of my favorite parts of the book too, because it's something that I didn't anticipate when I began researching into the filing cabinet, because I think like you, I was very much focused on the office. And what I developed, what I discovered, partly through my research, but also when I discovered the research of a scholar named Marianne Beecher, who unfortunately, her work is largely exists in her dissertation. It was never published in articles or as a book. But what we see here is that, in the language of my argument, the cabinet logic, right, the organization of the filing cabinet, gets moved out of the office into the home, not really through the filing cabinet. There are some filing cabinets making it into homes, but the logic of the filing cabinet gets into the home through closets and kitchen cabinets. It gets into the home through the storage spaces, right, of the home. And it brings with it, right, these changes in the storage organization of closets and kitchen cabinets, brings with it all these ideas of productivity and efficiency that we've been talking about. And this is all happening in the early 20th century when storage space is rethought, or the space of storage in the home becomes thought of in terms of the rationalization of space, right? So again, what's going on is this idea that saving time, productivity, efficiency is really key in the home. And so this also becomes particularly important as bungalows are built and your kitchen is only 120 square foot, or if you're living in an apartment building in a city. And so what happens is that the closets, for example, and kitchen cabinets, but closets, which sort of used to be an afterthought in the home, suddenly become very clearly defined. And in some ways, as I was looking at these articles on closets and kitchen cabinets and Better Home and Gardens and Ladies Home Journal and House Beautiful, it was almost like reading an IKEA catalog, right? Like this desire, you know, the way in which space is suddenly divided up and space is shaped so that particular objects can easily fit in it. So you'll in your closet, you'll make sure that there is a space where you can store boxes for your hats, or there'll be long drawers for your skirts, or shorter skirts, or boxes or pigeonholes for shoes. I mean, obviously the target here is a woman, right? And the organization of a closet for a woman. And then kitchen cabinets, right? the discovery, the older drawers were too deep. You couldn't pull things out from them. So what do? You divide drawers into sections to group related items together. And you do the same thing for shelves in cupboards, right, which could be made removable or stepped or sliding. And you even had upright partitions so plates could be stored on their side. And, you know, they were referred to in articles and advertisements that you could now file your plates. Right. And so, again, right, in these ads, and just more generally, ads accompanying these new kitchen cabinets, it would say the business of getting meals or the kitchen needs to be business-like. Right. So it's through this way, not through the filing cabinet itself, but through the logic of storage that the filing cabinet encapsulates that came out of the commercial needs of efficiency and information, that logic gets into the home. So again, back to what I said earlier, you know, this is just another example of how storage is not neutral, right? That these storage technologies make the values of corporate capitalism common sense in every day, right? It makes productivity critical to how women's work in the home is understood. And here I also want to give a shout out to the work of Melissa Gregg, who in her recent book, Counterproductive, she offers a history of productivity, and she makes sort of similar arguments to this as well, to really make us think about the ways in which the home is rethought as a site of productivity.
Yes, absolutely. Like, all of this discussion is reminding me of, you know, so the Frankfurt kitchen and the ways in which, you know, there are these plans drawn out to sort of think about, you know, how many steps must someone who is cooking take between the sink and the cooker and things like that. And how can you sort of reduce that so that cooking can happen much faster instead of all of these sort of Taylorist innovations, if you will, that are happening to streamline the kitchen to work in some ways like the office. And it hadn't really occurred to me to think about the parallels between the ways in which the filing cabinet is set up and the ways it sort of divides up space and the ways in which, say, the Frankfurt kitchen, like these sort of high efficiency kitchens are set up to divide up space in very specific kinds of ways. I'm going to move on a little bit, or rather dive more into this question of dividing things up in sort of almost fanatic manner. But before I do, I just wanted to call attention to the way in which you organize visually your book with these little tabs that you include at the top of each page, which denote the chapter and the section. And I really liked that sort of visual punnery, if you will, because you talk a great deal about the file cabinet's logics of dividing, of partitioning, assisted very much by the design of tabs and folders and things like that to make information retrieval more efficient. And so we often think of these divisions as logical and even neutral, but as you see, they are absolutely not. They have a very particular politics of power. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the kinds of values that shaped these types of partitioning that sort of shape how labor is performed. And if you could maybe extrapolate a bit, talk a little bit about how these paper-based systems of partitioning, of division, of controlling, if you will, have left traces in our current digital workspaces.
Well, yeah, I'm really glad you like the tabs that are occur at the top of each page, but I actually can't take any credit for that. So I want to thank the University of Minnesota Press design team for coming up with that. I was really happy when I saw the page proofs, and there they were. And also just, you know, the press as a whole for okaying so many images in the book, mm-hmm, and then ensuring that they were reproduced really well and really clearly, because some of these images are, you know, 19th century, early 20th century. They're not from great sources. Many of them I acquired from eBay, you know, well-worn pages. So, yeah, big shout out to the University of Minnesota Press for making the book look so good. Most of my answers, as you said, have alluded to this logic of partitioning, of grouping similar things together. And I've argued that this defines the filing cabinet, and it introduces what I call a very particular version, or a very 20th century version, of a cabinet logic. And just to sort of reiterate, I've sort of talked around this, but the tabbed manila folder and the tabbed guide cards are really critical to this, right? I mean, the manila folder is a development of the file, right? And the file, I think, is usefully thought of as a technology of gathering, right? Mm-hmm. And so what the manila folder does, though, it gathers things together, but it in a way in which through the tab, there is no need for a separate index, right? Because it used to be that you might have papers stored in various things that were called files, but the index, if there was one, was written up in a separate book. And right. In a separate place. So the tabs become very, very important in making what advertisers called a filing cabinet having an automatic index. And all they meant by that was that the index was in the drawer, the index was in the cabinet itself. And this also, what we see also here is that visibility becomes equated with accessibility. So another very common phrase from ads is that information is available at a glance. Mm-hmm. Right. So retrieval is the key. So what we're seeing here in the office is, which then gets pushed out to the home, as we were talking about a moment ago, storage becomes redefined as a problem of retrieval. And that gets us, of course, back to efficiency, right? Where saving time becomes incredibly important, because storage can often just be about saving space. Right. Storage can just be about space, right? An issue of space. I put something here in a space of storage. What happens with retrieval, of course, moves the issue away from thinking about space to thinking about time. Mm-hmm. And so the way we save time, according to the inventors of the filing cabinet, right, is through this idea of giving everything a particular place and making that place visible. And to really try and capture the values that are driving this, the economic values that are driving this, I talk about this thing that I call granular certainty. And in a most general sense, granular certainty to me is the drive in the early 20th century to break more and more of life and its everyday routines into discrete, observable, and manageable parts. So the logic here, and as you said, the logic here coming into many of us who have looked at this period through the writings of Frederick Taylor, right, the sort of logic here is the granular idea is you're breaking something down into small parts to produce a high degree of detail or specificity. And the certainty part is the idea, the belief that the greater specificity reduces individual discretion and therefore increases the likelihood that the task will be completed efficiently. Right. So the filing cabinet therefore becomes a way in which this logic of granular certainty is instantiated, right? And so what I find interesting here is that there's an overlap between efficiency's embrace of standardization and the conception of information as something discrete in particular, right? So, you know, the need for the demands of efficiency and productivity mean you need information, but the information that you're getting, the information that the form that the information is taking is also itself a product of efficiency and granular certainty. So we get the tabs, we get the specificity, the particularity, right, that gets labeled information, right? This when knowledge becomes defined in such an instrumental way, that particular bit of knowledge, that increasingly, at least in the business world, is called information.
Yeah. And, you know, it because it's become so commonplace, it's interesting to think of the ways in which tabs themselves, tabs, manila folders, and the filing cabinet become these technologies for, as you say, I don't know whether this is your term or whether it's their term, of automatic indexing. It seems, I think this was their term, of automatic indexing, of trying to say that visibility equals accessibility, and then that can be extrapolated into increased efficiency. And you take this even further to talk about how these various technologies are seen both materially and metaphorically to enhance or stand in for human memory itself. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, another favorite part of my book, I guess. It's all good. It's all my favorite.
No, it is all great. Yes.
To start to think about the way that the filing cabinet is marketed as an automatic index, but it's also marketed as having an automatic memory, right? Creating a memory for the office, and that memory is automatic. And this actually gets us back to the gendered labor of filing, right? And the point that I was making earlier, that, you know, women can grasp paper, right? They can handle paper, but they're not expected to grasp to understand its contents, right? And so this is because mm-hmm. the filing cabinet does all the thinking, right? And more specifically, it remembers the location of a particular piece of paper. So it's in this context that it's referred to as the memory of the office or the automatic memory of the office. And here, the argument that's put forward within the literature and within the advertisements is that human memory or personal memory can no longer be depended on because of the scale of the modern office. So here again, the modern office is always understood in this literature as the office of a corporation, right? Even though actually in the United States through the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, the average office size was under 25, right? But the technologies employed less than 25 people. But the technologies they were using came out of this logic, this idea that all offices were large. And so within the filing cabinet, with the filing cabinet, the idea is the office has become too large for any one individual to remember everything that is going on within it, right? So therefore, the filing cabinet is presented as extending human memory to the scale of modern capitalism. And so here it's extending, right, or in developing the long history of the idea of memory as a storehouse. Right, that memory is all about storing impressions in discrete spaces of the brain. Like the idea of the brain cell, right, comes from the Latin cella, sure I'm mispronouncing it, which means storeroom, right? But it also could refer to dovecots and compartments that bees make for honey, right? But it's all about the way in which memory has always been understood, right, through this idea of storing it, but storing it within discrete spaces, right? So memory becomes an idea of recollection. You're not learning by rote, but you're learning in early modern Europe by thinking through making connections, right? So it's this history of the understanding of memory that the filing cabinet is developing or picking up on, at least in its marketing, right? And so it's an automatic memory because the filing cabinet itself is also positioned as a machine. So within the business imagination of the early 20th century, all business is a machine, right? So the filing cabinet becomes a machine. So you call it automatic to emphasize that, right? And to emphasize that the memory that it brings is based on precision, consistency, speed, and reliability. And you do that within a file cabinet drawer by subdividing the alphabet into sometimes hundreds of subdivisions, right? 2-3-letter subdivisions, all so that you can look and find with ease, right? And without really thinking, without having to know anything other than the alphabet, right? You can find the particular piece of paper that you're looking for.
Yeah. And it seems one thing you caution against as you talk about this question of automatic indexing, automatic memory, is that it seems as though the filing cabinet is opening up this whole new world of information retrieval and the possibilities are endless. But you also caution and talk about some of the constraints or limitations that it enforced that still shape how labor is performed today. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit, I realize I asked a question about how these paper-based systems may have left traces in our current digital workspaces. And I wondered if you could either talk about that a little bit, or maybe to put this question differently, talk about how, you know, unpacking the question of storage capabilities of filing cabinets has changed how you yourself see processes of labor and work, of information storage, retrieval, or how office spaces themselves have come to be organized. You know, maybe what kinds of things have changed for you along the course of doing this research?
Yeah, thanks for bringing us back to the question you asked earlier about the traces of this
in
the 20th century, because I think I got a little bit carried away with my historical answer there. So yeah, I mean, obviously, one of the things that makes the filing cabinet, I think, an interesting object for us to think about, and to think about the idea that storage is not neutral, is the fact that even though we've moved increasingly away from paper as the basis for where information is recorded and stored and circulated, we still use these paper-based metaphors to think about how to organize paper, right? So as you, I think you alluded to in your earlier question, right, we still talk about tabs, we still talk about files. We used to, for a long time, have, you know, manila folder icons on our desktops. And in the 1980s and 1990s, the filing cabinet itself, you know, was an icon as a document folder. And as, of course, was, and we still have as like, we still, for our trash, when we trash something on our desktop, we throw it into a waste paper basket, which, you know, people often still refer to today as their round filing cabinet. So these things, like, so these ideas are still there. And I think that it's fascinating for us to, or important for us to acknowledge, right, going back to the vertical history argument, that these concepts, right, of the file, and then the way we think, are asked to think about and approach information through the file, come out of particular historical moments and bring with them particular historical values. And they all also, I think, and this is, I think, what you were also getting at with this question, right, is the way in which that can limit how we actually think about information. And there have been many critics, right, of the use of paper-based metaphors to think about digital information, right? And and one of the more famous quotes is, like, you know, to continue to use the file to think about digital information, you know, is like cutting the wings off a 747 and using it as a bus to drive down a freeway, right? You know, that these, and that comes from Ted Nelson, right, who was one of the founding fathers of hypertext, right? But I mean, I think that's a great quote, because it does capture and really make us think about, well, yeah, why do we use these things? Because it encourages us to not see connections. It encourages us to, in some ways, to dismiss or deny the messiness of the world, right?
Right.
The messiness of knowledge. And it pushes us towards that kind of knowledge, that kind of information, which we can look at with certainty. So I think that, you know, that's one of the things that I sort of, it was one of the reasons, as I started to really dig into the filing cabinet, I wanted to think about, right? And I wanted to, or I was thinking about, but it really did, as I did the research, I really started to, the significance of that, the limitations of that way of thinking really started to become very clear to me.
Yeah. And one thing I was thinking about, I realized that I've taken a lot of your time. So
it's been great. It's all good.
It's you know, sort of maybe coming back to the very first question I was asking you. I was wondering if there was anything in doing this research that may have set you on another train of thought or another journey, and I wondered what you might be working on now, and or what is next for you.
Well, yeah. This book took a long time to write and research.
I can imagine. It's very rich.
Thank you. Longer than I anticipated. So on the way, I've collected a lot of ideas For articles that have been put to one side. So I guess in the spirit of, you know, I'm not leaving behind this project in the sense that I have a lot of discrete, you know, standalone articles that I'm thinking about working on rather than diving back into trying to write another big monograph. So I've just actually, and it's really nice, right, to complete, yeah, to start and finish a project, right, and have it happen within a, maybe even a matter of months. So I just actually completed an article with a book historian, Deidre Lynch, about holes and paper. And this, you know, it picks up something that I touch on briefly in this book, which is about the emergence of loose leaf ledgers and ring binders, right? Which are, of course, another way to store paper. And Deidre's got a really fascinating argument about the use of pins to the way holes were created in paper to attach paper and other objects, right, to the pages of books. So we've written up something about holes and paper. So that's great. And there are other arguments like that or ideas that didn't make it into the book or just weren't quite good fits for the book that I would like to pursue. And then there are just other things that actually, going back to your very first question, you know, gets me back to identification documents. I really want to revisit something that I didn't really talk about in the book on the filing cabinet for reasons now that seem kind of, the book on the passport that seem kind of embarrassing, but that's when gender was added as an identification category to US passports, which actually, spoiler, at least to me, in the history of the passport, was surprisingly late, which was in the 1970s. So, you know,
well,
I have a lot of
interesting.
Yeah, and it's there's a whole other podcast about that one. So therefore, I think I have in that sense have enough to keep me occupied for the next couple of years, I hope, and maybe in that time a book length project might emerge. But I'm more than happy to work on, as I said, these sort of shorter, more discreet projects.
And I'm looking forward to seeing them as they emerge. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this book and your future projects with me. And I wondered, for those of our listeners who are interested in learning more, where can they find you? Where can they follow you and learn more about your work?
Okay, yeah. So I'm on Twitter. I'm not a big Twitter, but I'm on there at Craig2, the numeral 2 Robertson. And then I finally got around to creating my own website, and that's available. That's at craigrobertsonfiles.net. So those are two places where people can follow what I'm doing. And so, yeah, no, this is, I just want to say this has been a really great conversation. I really appreciate your questions, which show that you clearly took a lot of time with reading this book. So yeah, this has been a lot of fun.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation, and it really made me think about verticality, first of all. But even, you know, questions of furniture and the way they shape space in ways that I hadn't taken into account before. So thank you again for making the time to be with us on this podcast. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
This discussion of The Filing Cabinet, A Vertical History of Information, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2021, was brought to you by the New Books and Architecture channel of the New Books Network. Make sure to subscribe to our channel wherever you get your podcasts.